Welcome to the Big Mike Fun Podcast, where you learn about advanced wealth building strategies from real estate investing to creating massive ROI and secure retirement profits. So pour yourself a cup of coffee, grab a notepad, and lean in. Because Big Mike has got the mic, starting now.
Welcome to the Big Mike Fun Podcast. I'm the Big Mike.
Mike Zlotnik, and today it is my pleasure and a privilege to welcome Dan French. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Big Mike. Good to be on.
Thank you for coming on a podcast. Dan has orchestrated over $2 billion in assets under management as part of the ATX acquisitions as a managing director. He's also a leader of the residential property. It's a RESPROP, if I'm saying it correctly.
Yes.
Real estate, private equity, and property management firm, where he has overseen the operation of staggering 15,000 plus apartments and properties. Welcome one more time. Tell us a little bit about you, your family. Both of you and I went to the same college, SUNY Binghamton, yep, years ago. You're a little younger than me, but it was a great school. Yep. And tell us where you live, family. Let's cover that first.
Yeah, well, thanks again for having me on, Mike. And yeah, my family is, I have four kids, so very blessed there. And actually, it's my son's birthday today. He's my youngest guy.
He's happy birthday to your son.
Yeah. I celebrated with him a couple of different times already, and we'll celebrate again tonight. But yeah, I have four kids, three of them are girls. So I have a 10-year-old, an 8-year-old, a 6-year-old, and I got my boy, he's my fourth, and like I said, he's five. So, I live in Austin, Texas, and really one of the reasons I got involved in real estate 20 years ago and back in like 2004 was because I wanted to have a big family, and I wasn't married at the time. You know, I was young, and I felt that real estate was a great way to create future wealth. So that's what really had me say yes to a partnership that was proposed to me by my still business partner after 20 years. I'm still with the same person. His name is Pete Rex, someone I grew up with. And really, he approached me to go into business with him. And we started buying small deals pre-Great Financial Crisis. Thought we were really smart for a couple of years. And of course, it looked like we were. But then, we were part of this whole meltdown. You know, we did a lot of things that we would never do. And we learned a lot from the experiences. We powered through it. And between 2011 and 2019, that's when we bought $2 billion of total asset value. So roughly 17,000 apartments, focusing on Florida and Texas. And the end of that story, or kind of the pivot point in that story, is that in 2019, very frothy market, cap rates had compressed quite a bit. So we felt compelled to become net sellers. So we sold $1.5 billion of the $2 billion. And it was deal by deal, not in a portfolio sale. So we executed that between 2019, mostly, and 2020. And we sat on our hands for a little while, and now that's why we feel compelled that this is now actually a new buying opportunity because of what's happened with the Fed raising interest rates to, you know, from a historical standpoint, so fast, so rapidly, and it's causing a lot of owners to be under the gun, and we feel like we can scoop up great deals at a great basis. So brand new firm, ATX Acquisitions. Same founder, myself, still with him, Pete Rex, same founder, same, a lot of the same team, but different firm, but going after a new buying opportunity. That's the key.
Yeah, I appreciate that, that great overview. And well, God bless your family. You have three girls and a boy. I have the same setup, so it's a great.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, and they're also girls, cool. Are oldest, so.
No way.
Yeah, it happens sometimes. If you have enough kids, you meet enough people with a similar configuration. Let me put it this way.
But that's what's the age range of your group of your kids.
My oldest is 24, and they're all the way to 12. But wow. The oldest are girls, and the youngest is a boy. So I certainly can appreciate that. Mm-hmm. And the story that you have makes a lot of sense. I concur with your opinion completely that now we entering a period of time where the market is near the bottom, and we are likely going to see great opportunities ahead. So right. Folks who are shy, they can miss a great ride on a forward basis. although there's a lot of fear, uncertainty, doubt, concerns. So let me just ask a couple of questions. So you exited largest part of your portfolio in 2019. Was it 1 year or multi-year sale? And then the second question is how things are faring on things that you kept. Have you seen difficult deals? Have you, and again, this is not put anyone to the test. Have you seen some deals going south? And just curious, what's been your experience? And we'll talk about the forward outlook and the opportunities on that front.
Yeah, so that was like I said, we didn't package it up as a portfolio. We felt like we could maximize disposition value by doing it one by one, which is more work, you know. But basically, you know, brokers are happy to help you sell deals, and we had a wonderful team that was really focused on maximizing you know, sale price. And there's a whole host of things you can do around all of that. So we executed that over probably 18 months all told. And it went very well. I mean, perfect timing, right? Would have been like, oh, well, you know, crystal ball, perfect crystal ball. You would have held it right before the rates increased because there was again another run up. But who could have really foreseen that? It was really hard to foresee that. Like, we had already felt that cap rates had compressed to historical lows based on where we thought assets should trade based on intrinsic value, right? And then it just kept ramping up and up and up in this crazy environment of zero interest rates. So that was hard to foresee, and we'd rather have a good night's sleep for ourselves and for our LPs than try to, you know, be like perfect market timers. We want to be downside protected. So I think it all worked out pretty well. And then in between, you know, going through COVID as an operations team was difficult. And you asked how the assets have performed that we've held. The ones that we've held on to tended to be in like jewel locations, locations that we never wanted to, you know, we want to have ultra long-term hold mindset on those. Example, one of them is in Miami, on Biscayne Boulevard. It's a 400 unit deal. I think it's kind of a bulletproof asset because that market, is, you know, even though it has challenges with supply and everything, that deal has done very well from an occupancy standpoint, and even being able to push rents in ways that you don't see like in Austin with the supply problems that we've seen in Austin. So anyway, we really kind of like focused on the best possible locations that we thought could be bulletproof for long-term hold.
Yeah, sounds good. It's kind of funny. The South and Austin is one of the markets have seen a lot of oversupply, and most folks haven't really were prepared for it. But when you oversupply the market, the same, by the way, happened in storage. Kind of interesting observation. Multiple and storage is even worse than multifamily. You can oversupply. But let's go to it on a forward basis. So, what's a forward outlook now? What are you doing? Are you seeing great deals today? You're still waiting for these opportunities, and what kind of valuations corrections have you seen from the peak for in the markets where you're looking at? And just to confirm, you're operating mostly where in Florida and Texas, and what subsidiaries? Obviously, Miami and Austin. That's what I heard. Any other markets?
That's right, Mike. So we are focused on Florida and Texas, but within Texas, let's start there. We love Austin. You know, we're called ATX Acquisitions because of, you know, Austin, Texas. And I do think right now people are shorting Austin. And I think that's very temporary because they're worried about supply, and that's a valid concern. But if you talk to old real estate people, old hands in real estate in Austin, it's like, hey, just wait a little bit, and the absorption is going to come because job growth is crazy. It's dynamic economy, and the population growth is still going. So right now, it's an imbalance, but that's temporary in my view. So in Texas, we focus on Austin, and I'm actually physically in Dallas right now. So we love DFW. Unfortunately, I think a lot of people do. So we prefer to be contrarian, and picking up deals where other people don't see it. So DFW is very competitive. We're bidding on a deal right now in a very core location, and it had 60 tours. Just to put that into perspective, so a lot of deals don't get even half of that. So very competitive. That's a mid-rise building that we're in the mix on. Probably will be in best and final. So anyway, that's Texas, right? DFW, Austin. I'm not really that bullish on San Antonio, not that bullish on Houston. So we kind of avoid those markets for now. And then in Florida, we love Jacksonville still. Again, pick your spot. But we have a deal that's closing there in 2 weeks. And then love Tampa and South Florida broadly, like Naples all the way to Miami. Orlando, we're open too, but I haven't seen a lot of deals that I'm excited about there in Orlando. So let me pause there.
Yeah, I got you. How do you manage properties so remotely? You're Austin based, or maybe Austin and Dallas. How do you manage? Is one of the biggest challenges in multifamily is property management, and remote property management has been a challenge for many operators. It's not an easy exercise. So
Right.
do you have big feet in the ground in each market? Do you do in-house property management versus outsource?
Yeah, no, it's a great point, Mike. And so how we're set up is I think somewhat unique. So like I said, I described that firm that bought $2 billion in asset value. When it came down to after you sold the 1.5 billion, your unit count that you were managing, right, because it was vertically integrated. It was all of our property management only served assets that we had ownership stake in. So we pivoted that firm, and now it serves third-party owners. So it grew back from, let's say, at its bottom, it was at 3,500 units, which was small compared to where we were. We grew it back up to 15,000 now. So we have boots on the ground all throughout Texas, all throughout Florida. 15,000, to put it into perspective, is not quite the top 50. In the US, but the top 50 cutoff would be like 35,000 units. So maybe in a couple of
It's
years, we're in
sizable.
the top 50.
15,000 units is pretty sizable. It
It's
certainly
sizable. Yeah.
can operate pretty well in a few markets.
Yeah. So how we are set up now, even though that's technically an affiliate company of ATX Acquisitions, right? Like same ownership, same founder, right? Pete, my business partner. I have a business interest in both companies, but ATX utilizes ResProp because we feel like they're best in class property management for our deals in Florida and Texas. We think they're an amazing group, right? Because we built them, and so that gives us boots on the ground, and it allows ATX Acquisitions to be focused more on the investment and allocation, capital allocation side, and then ResProp manages all the construction, property management, market intelligence, comp set intel. And that's what they do. So we have a third party relationship with them, an affiliate relationship, but it works out really, really well.
Yeah, makes sense. So it sounds like it's in-house for an affiliate company type of, and makes a lot of sense. So you talked about a deal in Dallas that you're bidding on, and you're seeing pretty competitive bidding.
Yeah.
So let me take a step back. What we've talked about is cap rate, were compressed to unbelievable point. Have they expanded to what degree? First of all, just what are you seeing out there as far as let's call it DFW market, and then Austin. Just curious, and then are you looking for distressed seller situations, or are you looking for competitive deals? It's kind of one of those the different strategies. If you feel you're looking for a top asset, then you are bidding against a bunch of people, and are you really getting a deep discount? Or maybe the play on that asset is very different versus trying to pick up distressed seller situations that have, basically they're squeezed by the floating rate debt or whatever it is.
For sure. Well, I do think that coming off the height of where asset value was in our target markets, we're seeing anywhere from 20 to 30% off of those prices, right? So, and that to me makes a lot of sense because the debt.
This is both, but that was for Wharf and Austin,
Yes.
are 20 to 30% down on the valuation
Right.
relative to the peak, right?
Yeah, and it depends. Like, I think Class A pricing has not seen, that's probably where you're at 20%, right? Class C, you're at 30%. And there's reasons for that because one of them is that famously, I think these sort of like newer groups, syndicator groups that were brand new to the game, they came in and they there was more of them, so they bid up pricing, and their entry point was Class C, because that's where they were competitive. That's there were, cheaper deals, or purchase price was lower, so they got in, they crowded into that space, they pushed up temporarily the pricing, and now it's come back to earth and it's hit Class C harder. Does that make sense? That's what I
Yeah,
see.
of course. Yeah.
And then the Class A buyer set is more durable. Although I do think institutions are still on the sidelines. Maybe they're starting to come back in, but there's a lot more people still excited to, get a brand new, maybe it's 2022 delivery, 2023. That buyer set is more, it's still there, because if you're talking about a 70 million plus deal, a small syndicator group was not doing that anyway,
Yeah, of course. Yeah, that's so how you're raising capital today. What you just described is a phenomenon where the class C and smaller asset prices fallen greater than the better assets for a simple reason that today raising equity has gotten incredibly difficult. And these mom and pop operators, well, maybe some of them are not even mom and pop, some have grown to be significant, but most of the capital has come from individual investors. And a lot of these folks are shying away from writing fresh checks because they're losing their shirt on many of the deals, right? So I'm just curious, how are you raising capital for your deals today? Have you transacted at all this year? Are you looking to transact? I'm just curious.
So when we raised our fund, so we have a general partner fund where, myself and partners have put our capital into the fund, and then we'll take other high net worth people that want to come alongside us. And the fund is essentially roughly 10% of every deal. And then deal by deal, we'll syndicate the rest of the equity capital. And then, so once we get there, it depends how big the raise is. And we've found success recently, though, with high net worth individuals, many of whom have invested with us in the past, and now we've reintroduced ourselves and say, hey, we're back at it. And they've come back and invested with us, or brand new people just from being active on LinkedIn, holding events, trying to add value to people and be known as someone who's looking to be active. We've also found some success with these groups that are known as fund to fund groups. So they might take $1 million position in our fund. They're technically passive, right? They won't get decision rights in the deal, but then they'll go raise capital $50,000 at a time and come in through like an SPV, a special purpose vehicle with one check of let's say $1 million. And we're also open to joint venture groups, joint venture, type partnerships with groups that can stroke bigger checks. So we've explored all kinds of things. To answer your question about how we transacted yet this year, yes, we have. Our first deal in the fund was last year in Austin, in September, I think. Then we closed another one in Dallas here in April, and now we're about to close on a deal in Jacksonville, in 2 weeks. So it's been good. It's been hard to put together deals, and hard to find deals that they're actually making sense. Because I think you asked earlier, have we seen the distress? The answer I think is mostly no. We thought it would be more of a market impact, and I think it's unraveling more slowly than we thought. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. But if the price is corrected 20 to 30%, that's already by definition, in essence. There's been so some of it, you're right, overpayment on some assets. On the other side, when 20 to 30% correction happens, it is a generally, sort of distressed. Well, which I guess change market condition. Let's not call it distressed. You're picking up these assets not necessarily from distressed sellers, just from the sellers who want to transact in this market, but they're willing to discount that much, 20 to 30%, right? That's what you're seeing.
And I think there is some nuance here, Mike, right? Like, especially if you're placing new debt. Well, real estate's a financial asset that typically would be roughly two-thirds, or nowadays maybe a little bit less, but it's a debt-driven asset. And so largely what you can pay for it is driven by the price of your debt. So when debt has become more expensive, to me, it makes sense that's going to eat into what you can pay for that deal. That's why if you see assumable debt, let's say if you're assuming a crazy low interest rate that you can't get anymore, like 3%, well, your price on that deal specifically is going to be higher than the same exact deal that would that you need to place new debt execution on, right?
That's right.
So that's how I view things. So it does make sense to me that pricing should be down because, you know, your debt service coverage ratios and all these different things that get baked into what you can pay for a deal. Well, now it's changed. So and insurance, like I'm in two states that are that have been heavily impacted by insurance. So you have to bake that into the equation as well. Yeah, there's uncertainty there. So even though we've had a correction, it doesn't feel like you're just getting like an 08, you know, you could buy like a 10 cap deal. And just crazy distress. Like now, I think it's a little bit more, you have to be more picky.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So you chatted a couple of black swan events. One, obviously COVID and the whole inflation and interest rates hiking, and the other one, natural disaster events, insurance companies hiking insanely, and both of them sort of hit the multifamily industry and other commercial real estate pretty significantly. And of course, this whole argument of assumable debt versus new debt on a deal, it makes sense. If somebody's selling it to you with assumable debt, they will be pushing for a higher price because they can. And you wind up obviously paying higher price, but having more predictability of that lower interest rate for some amount of time. So from that perspective, it makes a lot of sense that you can pay more for that asset versus brand new debt. But in general, the good old rule is buy when the rates are high, refinance when the rates are low.
Yeah.
And I would rather buy with a deeper discount today with fresh debt than take assumable debt and pay higher price for the reasons that all other things being equal, if it's purely engineering, financial engineering exercise, then of course you better get a better price. Assuming it's the same debt service coverage ratio, higher right. loan, at this point, the rates have no place to go but down. At least this is my opinion, although your guess is as good as mine. We'll see what happens. So a couple of other quick questions. So your capital raising today, and you said you sounds like you set up a GP fund that is participating to a degree of 10% on most of your deals, and then you're raising LP checks directly into these type of deals.
Mm-hmm.
So what type of returns do you need to offer investors today in this environment when the price has corrected quite a bit? What do target LP returns look like today for the deal to be attractive? Just curious, what are you seeing out there?
Yeah, for the deals that are like 1980s type deals that have a little bit of value add, we don't like full, you know, crazy turnaround stories at this point, but those type of deals are getting, you know, high, very high teens, like let's say 19 or even like bumping up against 20% net IRR.
And these are low risk deals. These are light value adds, if anything, right? These
are not light value adds. So exactly. So not crazy heavy execution risk on the deals. Just try to pick the pocket, pick the pocket and of the submarket that you're in, beware of new supply, and then, you know, lock in the great basis that you can get today. Now we're starting to look at some of these, what some people call like core plus deals. They're newer, 2019 vintage and newer, let's say. Those sometimes have more of like a net 13, 14, 15 IRR. And we'll see. We haven't transacted one of those recently. We have in our past, but that's a different profile of investor capital. So I do think there's some appetite for that though.
And you don't do any heavy value adds. So that's you don't do deals that have to return targets in the mid 20s where there's more work involved.
No, we've done that in our past. You know, I don't feel like now is the proper time to take that execution risk. Mostly because I'm afraid if can you get paid back for it? You know, you've already seen a historic rise in the markets we have, right? During COVID, like some year over year stuff was like 20%. So I think there's upward balance of what people can pay of their wallet share per month on rent. So if you're bumping up against that.
Well, what you're hitting is an upper limit affordability. So if you can't,
exactly.
Then the deal shouldn't even pencil, right? at that point, the numbers are not believable. You can't even confidently build conservative projections. So I hear you. And one question, I'm just curious what you're seeing. The return profiles in the core plus deals in the mid-teens, this was the norm in the past, and it sounds like it's still the norm today, but these numbers are returns on equity in that range relatively to some of the debt opportunities today. We do a bunch of deals where we can loan money and get equity-like returns without equity-like risk. Numbers basically in the very high teens into 20s in debt today, in mezz financing, bridge financing. So I'm just curious, my thought process, and I may be wrong, if I'm going into equity today, right? I want to see a really deep buy and I want to see IRRs in the, so let's call it mid-20s. If the deal doesn't pencil for that, you're not buying it deep enough. You're competing against too many people. You're trying to transact rather than trying to get a great deal. So what are your thoughts?
Fair points, and I'm sure you're going to do very well with that thesis. And so I would have two counterpoints. One would be, debt is not as tax advantaged when you're going into a pure debt investment, right? It's not treated as capital gains. So, and also you can't take the depreciation you can get on a deal. So there's some
Agreed.
tax advantage going into a deal like we have. Secondly, to your point about like the refinance scenario, we don't bake that into what we show people. I mean, we'll show them a refinance scenario, but we don't want them investing based on that, right? We want them investing on a base case. Here, we're placing long-term debt. Maybe there's some interest-only period, but it's a fixed debt, and there's a term that's longer than 5 years. So we'll show them that scenario. But I do think there's a really strong case, and I think you made it that rates are going to come down, and we'll be able to refi. And the refi scenario almost certainly is going to increase the IRR. So you have an upside scenario that I don't think people, I think we should high five if it happens on a deal, but we shouldn't necessarily think like, oh wow, it's going to really become a 17 or 18. But I do think that's a very strong possibility that that happens, that you've had a good 2 years, you boost up your NOI, you execute your business plan, rates come down, you refi, and you return a lot of capital, and that's going to juice the IRR.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. Great minds think alike. I certainly like that idea. One quick question: what kind of debt do you place on these deals? Because generally speaking, if you get fixed rate debt, you're forced to have a prepayment penalty or yield curve curve maintenance. And if you take bridge debt, you don't have a any prepayment penalty, but you're usually paying substantially higher rates on a bridge debt. So I'm just curious, what are you leveraging on your deals to be able to refi without heavy prepayment penalties?
Yeah, no, that's part of the equation. But we've favored Freddie and Fannie type executions in our deals and doing fixed debt. And yes, there's some prepayment penalties and all that stuff. I think you just have to bake that into your analysis as you think you're in the money in the future on a refi scenario. That's just part of the cost of placing the new debt on it. So we look for IO period of at least 2 years on some of the older stuff, but we're seeing 5 years of IO, which is really going to help your cash on cash, which is nice. And then that's a future problem that you're going to have some defeasance costs.
How bad are these costs? What are you seeing if you're planning for a 5 year 5 year deal and the rates drop meaningfully in, let's call it two years? Have you modeled this? I'm just curious. Because I'm a mathematician degree from Binghamton
Yeah.
Mathematics, so
I
I
don't
don't
know
like
if
the
off the top of
numbers.
my head. I don't want to misspeak. I'll get back to you on that. How about that?
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, I appreciate it. This is very helpful. A lot of great information. Very interesting. How you're looking at these things and the fact that you don't want to deal with heavy lifts, just focusing on a little bit easier lifts, but still seeing 20-30% discounts and can still transact in this environment. So appreciate it. How would folks reach out? What's the best way to reach out, learn more, chat with you?
Hit me on my personal cell. I've been giving it out for years now, and I love it when people text me or reach out. It's 845-629-1808. And some people have reached out after I've given it out on podcasts, and please do. And also on LinkedIn, I think is a good way. I try to be very active on there. It's Daniel French. So you can search that, Daniel French, ATX Acquisitions. That'll almost certainly get you to me, and DM me or whatever. Email me. All my stuff is on there. So yeah, thanks for that, Mike.
Yeah, I appreciate you sharing. I appreciate being available to folks. Not too many people want to share their cell, and it takes courage. So,
yeah.
You can get phone calls in the middle of the night. Hey, I'd like to chat. But
right.
Thanks again. Appreciate you, and we will keep chatting. Well, thank you again, Dan.
Yeah, I appreciate being on. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. To receive your copy of Mike's How to Choose a Smart Real Estate Fund book, head to BigMikeFund.com or visit Amazon and type Mike's slot name. Keep listening and keep investing Big Mike style. See you on the next episode.